Welcome to the Jason and Scott Show, your source for the latest news and trends in the e-commerce industry. Featuring host Jason Retail Geek Goldberg, Chief Commerce Strategy Officer and Publicist, and Scott Wingo, CEO of Get Spiffy and co-founder of Channel Advisor. Here are Jason and Scott.
Welcome to the Jason and Scott Show. This is episode 318 being recorded on Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. I'm your host, Jason Retail Geek Goldberg. And as usual, I'm here with your co-host, Scott Wingo.
Hey, Jason, and welcome back, Jason and Scott Show listeners. Jason, one of the topics that is coming up a lot this year, we talked about it a lot in our recap and our preview, is Temu.
I like it. Yeah, it's mine. The prices blow my mind. I feel so rich. I feel like a billionaire.
By many measures, people think they're one of the fastest growing e-commerce companies in history. If you watch the Super Bowl, I think they spent $8 trillion on ads there. So we want to do a deep dive into this and cover a number of topics. We want to talk about a little background there on Temu. What's it mean for U.S. retailers? And you know, it's a Chinese company. Does it even matter? If yes, why? Because Temu isn't public and they are a Chinese company, they don't really disclose any information. So we wanted to bring on a guest that is basically a Temu expert. So we looked around and we found Michael Maloof. He is the head of marketing at Earnest Analytics. Earnest works with world-class data partners to acquire, anonymize, and productize insights about the U.S. economy. They have posted lots of articles. This is how we found Michael. I think you know him as well from the trade show circuit. So he's going to help us do this deep dive into what's going on at Temu. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show. Big fan of your annual predictions and the work you guys do. So I'm head of marketing at Earnest Analytics. We're the leading credit card, retail pricing, and healthcare claims data provider for investors and retailers. Before Earnest, I was actually a tech and telco analyst over at Goldman. The two credit card data sets we work with now, Orion and Vela, are probably the most pertinent to my conversations about the consumer economy and certainly this conversation today about Temu. They sourced respectively from a large account aggregator, like a budgeting app, and part of a POS system in the US. And Earnest essentially takes these massive and messy data sets, normalizes structures, and then puts them onto our platform so everyone from portfolio managers to marketers can see this third-party data. For example, you'd see market share, competitive benchmarking, customer behavior, revenue predictions, and macro trends for thousands of companies, including Temu.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. And then, so which sector did you cover when you were an analyst at Goldman Sachs?
Tech and telco. So anything in the tech space, we had a few marketplaces in there, telecom companies. It's been a while though. Earnest has been my home now for 7 years.
Okay. Was this in the Anthony Noto era you were there?
This was in the Vera Rossi era. She was my lead where we covered Latin American tech and telco.
Very cool. Awesome. Yeah they did. Goldman did the Channelvisor IPO. So I get to know the team there pretty well. Awesome. Well, before we jump into the data, which we're excited to kind of hear what you have to share here, Jason, I know this has become a very hot topic in your world. You spoke on it at NRF. You, in your day job, you're getting tons of questions about this. I think you're booked out solid with Temu briefings. So those people pay big money for it, and our listeners don't pay. What give us the free version of your backgrounder on Temu.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. And I'm sure we'll spice in some other tidbits as we go, but I'll try to give a concise bullet. Temu is a subsidiary of a company that used to be called Pinduoduo in China. It's now called PDD Holdings, which is infinitely easier to spell, by the way. And PDD Holdings is one of the largest e-commerce companies in China. On a market cap basis, they keep flip-flopping with Alibaba, so they're super competitive. They're way north of like $400 billion in GMV. In China and had a really interesting trajectory. But a couple of years ago, they launched Temu into first UK and then US, now 49 other markets as a new retail concept. And so a couple of things I'd want folks to know before we dive in with Michael. First of all, it's the name is a loose English acronym for team up, price down. So I always pronounce Temu as in team. There are multiple pronunciations out there, even from Temu employees. So I'm not sure there's an official pronunciation. In the United States, they launched in September of 2022. So they're about 18 months old now. And most folks were not familiar with them until a surprise, 3 months after launching, they bought a Super Bowl ad. So they became familiar to millions of Americans with the Shop Like a Billionaire ad that ran in the Super Bowl in 2023. And then, as Scott alluded to, they bought 5 ads in the Super Bowl this year. So they haven't disclosed what they paid. A normal 30-second spot in the Super Bowl costs about $7 million. They ran 4 ads during the Super Bowl and 1 during the postgame. So estimates are in the kind of $20 to $30 million that they spent just on that ad. There's a bunch of estimates for how big they are in the U.S. I'm eager to hear what Michael thinks, but his old rivals at Morgan Stanley have them at about $16 billion in GMV in the U.S. But more interesting, Morgan Stanley estimates they're going to be $32 billion by 2030. So you think about a retail company that launched in September of 2022, and then in the first year of business sold $16 billion worth of stuff. That's the fastest growing retailer of all times. We do know from other sources that they get more traffic every year than Target. They've been the most downloaded shopping apps on the Android and Apple app stores since they were born. So they've kind of owned the top of that list. And a couple other little interesting things. They are a marketplace. They have invented a model they call next generation manufacturing. So they're a marketplace. It's all 3P sellers that are selling goods on Temu. But unlike traditional Western-based marketplaces, Temu does a lot more of the work of listing the products and fulfilling the products for the factories. So if you're a factory, they say the only thing you need is a cellular internet connection, and they provide you all the infrastructure to become a successful seller on Temu. There's somewhere between 80 and 100,000 Chinese factories that are currently sellers on the marketplace. And then one big innovation is this week, they are turning on the ability for U.S. marketplace sellers to sell and fulfill their goods from the U.S. as well. So one interesting question about a marketplace is, are they competing for sellers with Amazon and Walmart? And now they're bringing that fight to American soil. So that, I feel like, is enough to get us started. That, you know, they're certainly an interesting company that's worth following. What the way I originally discovered Earnest is through this show. One of our most popular guests, Dan McCarthy, has been on a few times talking about his CLV methodologies, and our listeners have really enjoyed his commentary. He has partnered with Earnest Data several times to do some really interesting analytics, and you guys at Earnest have published a couple of those as thought leadership. And so that's how I first met you. And then, Michael, I noticed you published like 3 articles on Temu this year.
That's right. Temu has been one of the top client asked for themes. It's definitely something we're seeing a lot in the press. We work a lot with those thought leaders as well. And that's something that we're getting a lot of questions on from everyone from, you know, business of fashion to Dan McCarthy. So Dan, glad to answer any questions there. We are kind of in a unique spot, kind of have a dashboard on the consumer economy, if you will. Basically, what's going on within the last few days, we can see everything from customer acquisition they have to their gross market merchandise value.
Got it. Let's start at the basics and let's pretend, you know, so I see Temu and, you know, it looks like they've got, and you know, one of my theories is it feels a lot like Wish.com. So it's really kind of cheap stuff, slower ship going to what I would call value oriented consumers. You know, in your data, what kind of customer is buying this? And then how fast do you think they are really growing?
Yeah, let me answer the second one first. Temu's growing very quickly. Like you said, from late 2022 onwards, our data is showing double-digit month-to-month growth, which is just explosive, right as it became a household name. In the first 3 months, for context, it had roughly as many weekly active users in the U.S. as the largest fast fashion brand, Shein, and within 10 months had surpassed Shein in sales. And it had taken Shein years to get to that point. So really a much shorter timeline. For an idea of size, About 18% of U.S. households have shopped at Temu since its launch. And in terms of GMV, in February, we saw about 1% of Amazon's U.S. GMV. If you look at that, if you just break that out over the whole year, I believe in 2023, their net sales were something like over $500 billion. You're looking at around $50 billion in gross market or gross merchandise value moving through the service. But nevertheless, it's kind of not made really meaningful inroads with the largest online brands. I mean, it's still 1% in a good month. And that's actually decelerated since 2023. In fact, February of 2023 had fewer sales than January, despite the really heavy advertising spend you mentioned. So there's some signs that the growth is kind of changing there. Mainly that retention is increasing, even while this like new customer acquisition based sales growth model is slowing down. Temu's average customer lifetime value tracks higher than Walmart, and we're seeing customers becoming much more loyal. So that's an interesting kind of plus for them, while sales in total are kind of hitting a lull. But yeah, let's talk about who those customers are too. Yeah. It's definitely been one of the more interesting finds from our data. Despite the really low price points, that kind of gamified discount system, Temu's U.S. customer base skews middle to high income, actually. Sales among customers earning that over 190K, which is obviously very high up there, they're the fastest growing income bracket. And that's from May of 23 to January 24. So those sales to customers, earning under 55K, like less than the median US household income, that's actually the slowest growing. So today, about 44% of Temu sales come from earners making over 130K. Not only do high-income earners account for the largest share, you know, they're outgrowing. We just think that Temu resonates mostly with customers with more disposable income, people who can afford to take a gamble on an item that might not work out. It's you know, you buy a floor mat for $5, it doesn't work. A middle high-income person might just say, hey, it was $5 wasted, but the poor people don't always look at that. They're looking for a little bit more bang for their buck, can't afford that type of gamble. Yeah, it's interesting.
Cool. And then you mentioned that their LTV is going up. Do you have any insight into why? Are they getting better at like maybe predictive analytics or a recommendation engine, or, you know, they see Jason bought some gadget and then they know he's now a gadget geek and they kind of start targeting? Do you have any insight into what's driving that bump in LTV?
That's a good question. So I don't really have much insight into that. I try not to get out over my skis in terms of the data that I have available to me. We're looking at retention. We're looking for what's called a smile. Dan McCarthy talks about it all the time, which is over time as a company starts to bring back more customers that stopped spending with them. And that's been pretty rare to see in e-commerce history. That's something they've managed to do. How they're doing that, you know, I'm not totally sure. It's definitely going to be the key for them to continue growing as new customer growth slows down, though.
Yeah. Jason, do you know?
Yeah. Well, so I don't know. I just want to point out that, well, Michael is wisely trying to not get over his skis. I live over my skis, so I'll so I'll tumble down the ski slope once again. One of the things I maybe should have said up front, or maybe apparent to a lot of people, is Temu's marketing spend isn't just that Super Bowl ad. They're spending a fortune on digital ads and almost certainly losing a lot of money on every sale. So there's a Wall Street Journal article that came out this week that said that they Temu or PDD overall spent over $2 billion with Facebook and was Facebook's largest advertiser. They're also Google's largest advertiser in the US. And so they're buying a lot of customers, and the Wall Street Journal estimates that they're losing $6 on every sale. They're spending so much on customer acquisition. And so in that first year, they're doing a ton of marketing. There's a ton of people that never heard of Temu. They're acquiring those customers. They're getting that first order. And, you know, a mini version of this is what Wish did until they ran out of money. But it doesn't seem like there was a lot of evidence that Wish ever got traction, right? Like they didn't get those repeat orders. And what I think we're seeing and what I've seen in some of the data that Michael shared with us is that Temu very much is growing that LTV, getting repeat orders, even as the flood of digital marketing they're spending is sort of losing some efficacy as the law of large numbers kick in. And then I would also say Pinduoduo in China and now Temu in the US is very well known for their gamification. So they have lots of clever gamification mechanics on their websites, group buying, contests, gifts, one-time deals that are all like very carefully crafted to entice you to make an incremental purchase and to make an unplanned purchase. So I think all of those things appear to be working, and then they hit you on social media with, you know, a huge spend, you know, right when you're doom scrolling and expressing some purchase intent through your clicks.
Very cool. How about you, Michael, you mentioned this slowdown, which is exactly opposite of what I would have thought given the Super Bowl ads. Does the data show you anything there? Is it normal or like what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what would be normal for this company that's still up hundreds of percent a year. But when I'm looking at month over month growth, which is the kind of the best way I can think to look at it, it is pretty remarkable. There was some sort of a step change in August of last year where it went from growing double digits each month to growing just single digits or down. The holidays, you know, December actually was smaller than November in terms of their sales. And January was smaller still, makes sense. But February also very challenged in terms of sales. I'm wondering if they're in a sort of spiral in terms of the new customers' first time kind of buying frenzy is over, or if this is a shift towards very purposely trying to get people in the door and they're just actually tapping the brakes a bit on advertising spending. I'm not totally sure what this signals just yet.
Got it. Okay.
Is it safe to say that like there's no clear evidence that spending $30 million on the Super Bowl had a had a super observable impact on their sales?
Okay. Yeah. So the Super Bowl. Let's talk about that. The $1 million question or $30 million question, I guess. The answer is probably not. There are a lot of ways to measure advertising effectiveness, as you guys know better than most, you know, brand awareness and net promoter score. But yeah, for a young company like this facing slowing new customer growth, I'd imagine they're looking to move the needle with each of these like big marketing events. And the data just suggests that their multiple ads on February 11th had no meaningful boost in sales. Actually, Temu saw a noticeable deceleration in sales growth following the event. Actually, kind of like sales were significantly slower in the next few days. So unless they're measuring this on a much longer timeline, I don't think this investment was worth it. I think they would be better just plowing dollars into digital, wherever that is.
Yeah, it's super interesting. You know, obviously, for listeners that don't know, my salary gets paid by those Super Bowl ads. I work for a big ad agency, for which I'm very grateful. But the lot of controversy around our water cooler the day after the show, that was a spin that you rarely see. And in one metric, it clearly had an impact. There was a lot more discussion about Temu than any other company on social media the day after the Super Bowl. So the Super Bowl ads triggered awareness and conversation. I think they were the second behind Verizon, which had Beyonce, right? And so there was a lot of talk on social media. It was not all positive. There was a lot of discussion on social media, but people that hated the Temu ad the first time they saw it, because it was sort of, by Super Bowl standards, not a very high production animated ad. I think they made it in-house and they you know, ran it with much greater repetition than audiences are used to. So it generated a lot of conversation that didn't necessarily translate to sales, at least that we can measure in the short term. And so that's going to be interesting long-term case study about what these kind of, you know, splashy big reach audiences can and can't do.
Right. You know, I don't, again, skis and getting over them. It just seems like the outcome for them at this point should be a little further down the funnel. And I don't see how advertising spend like that will marginally get someone, persuade someone to buy a TMU that wasn't already going to. It seems, it was a lot, and there's no really movement in our data, either in new signups or in sales. I think there's some other research out that downloads are trending downwards or slowing down as well. We don't have that data, but I was reading elsewhere. So I think, Scott, this is maybe more to your 2024 prediction that people are realizing this is Wish and slowing and becoming less enamored or falling out.
No. Scott's predictions cannot be right.
Wait, if I hear that, you're pre-anointing that I'm right. Is that you're here in March, you're saying I was right with my prediction. Man.
Okay, well,
I'm good.
Right. I didn't want to pick a side here, but I think people might be falling out of love with it, although it's not because it's not Wish. It's because they're out wishing Wish. We can talk to it a little bit, but I think people just realize, you know, TMU is managing to disrupt Wish, and we can talk through the brands that it's disrupting. That's just one of many. It's got higher retention, bigger scale than Wish, but it does have the same limits as Wish, and that this deep discount model doesn't have the big household brands that people want when they're making those like everyday purchases that are slightly bigger, that like the Tides and Cloroxes or the recognizable alternatives. Like, there are just some things you don't want to replace, so you don't want to gamble on. I don't think anyone wants to spend a dollar on detergent and see what happens. It's just going to be tough for them to scale at some point. I think the question we should be asking is if they've reached that point yet. And I'm not sure. The sales growth slowing kind of suggests they could have. But in the meantime, they are actually taking a wrecking ball to several other brands. So just because total sales is slowing doesn't mean the disruptive effect is slowing.
Yeah, let's go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say one other factoid. I know we want to pivot, and Scott's champing at the bit there. One other advertising factoid, besides the wrecking ball they might be taking to some retailers, all of this digital ad spend is taking a wrecking ball to the cost of some of these digital ads. So one of the funny things I saw was in Etsy's earnings call, the CEO of Etsy called out that, like, hey, it's costing us a lot more money to buy an ad on Facebook because Temu is buying so many ads and driving the price on all those auctions up. So don't know if it's moving the needle on consumer impact or not, but it for sure is having an impact on their competitors, at least in that regard.
So you're saying maybe their goal is to just suck all the oxygen out of the room? So
I'm saying that's potentially an unintended positive benefit.
Yeah, and you've teed us up there. Who is it retailers or is it more brands? Who's getting impacted by this? And kind of embedded in this question is, do you have an idea of the categories? Like, if we looked at that pie of the $50 billion GMV, is it largely electronics? Is it apparel? Like, what are the big wedges inside of there?
Yeah, well, so the great part about transaction data, it's really good at looking at brand disruption, or I should say retail disruption by brand. Not great at looking at the categories. You know, I don't see what an individual breakout of a credit card receipt is. I'm just seeing where people are spending. So I think that's the question I'm more equipped to answer. In terms of impact, some of the folks you think of when you think of mass market and discount retailers like Five Below and Walmart, the ones that you immediately want to ask if they're being disrupted, they seem like they'd have the most overlap. They've been pretty untouched, actually. Part of its overlap, you know, only 19% of Walmart and Amazon's customers have even tried TMU. And that's about the same as the total percent of U.S. households that have tried it. You know, substantially the whole country has made a purchase at Walmart and Amazon. So they're just not as at risk, maybe on the margins. But what we're seeing, I guess, next step up with some risk is the dollar stores. Dollar General, that share about a quarter of their customers with TMU. And if you look at Dollar General's customer spending at TMU, it's up over 800% year to year from January 23 to 24, obviously a super small base, and flat at Dollar General itself. And then those TMU customers who aren't, or those Dollar General customers who aren't TMU customers, they're spending slightly up at Dollar General. It suggests that there's some impact. Again, not the biggest that we've seen. So I'd say like dollar stores kind of marginally, this is not as supported by data, but just putting the data point together that the TMU customers are spending less and TMU customers are richer, you could come to the conclusion that Dollar General is losing out on richer customers looking for deals a little bit. Maybe they're popping in for something they really don't want to spend a lot of money on, like a party, something like that. That's where the sale is that they're losing is, which actually kind of takes us to the last and biggest impact. Wish and AliExpress, as well as all those like Hobby Lobby, party supplies, like Oriental Trading. So I'll start with Wish. Their customers are just fleeing. I think there's no better way to say it. 50% less spend on Wish in January 2024 than January 2023. And over 680% increase at TMU. That's just astounding. The Wish customer, once they try TMU, they're done. It's game over. It's similar for AliExpress. And I think that what TMU's really done early on, we need to think of them less as like an Amazon killer and more as a brand that just came in to consolidate the existing demand for this deep discount online spending that these two, AliExpress and Wish, kind of got off the ground in the US. In terms of the hobby space, Oriental Trading, Hobby Lobby, Party City, they all experienced double-digit declines year on year in February among the customers who also shopped at TMU. And these brands, you know, they're catering to occasional and discount merchandise. I think they're really going to struggle adapting to TMU. It's like I said, the person who doesn't mind throwing away $5, $10, $15 on party supplies if they don't work out, but it's a one-time thing anyway. It's things that they're somewhat disposable items to these customers and very interchangeable.
Got it. I noticed you didn't mention Amazon in that list. Is there been an Amazon impact, or has it been zero or negligible?
Good catch. Pretty negligible. Just like Walmart. They're just brands on those platforms at this point that you can't find at these places. I think when I say on the margins, that's what I mean. There could be, hey, I need this small thing for my kitchen that I could get for a dollar, get for $3. And that might be the sale they lose out on, but they're doing a better job of being one-stop shops. And I think with what we've seen, it doesn't seem like the business model is set to take on Amazon yet.
Got it.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, a couple of things that come to mind. I think the dollar store thing is super interesting because historically, dollar stores haven't sold very much online. Like, and you know, usually their excuse is that super low price point discounted items don't work online, right? And I think, like, in some ways, I look at TMU and I say they're actually the digital dollar store that did figure it out. Now, like, it remains to be seen whether they can make money doing it in the long run. But it doesn't surprise me that those are some of the categories that are being disproportionately impacted. And I think you really hit something interesting on some of these everyday essential retailers that sell, you know, the brands that consumers are looking for and trust. That to me feels like a different shopping occasion than the shopping occasion I think TMU is winning. There's this whole new trend on all the social media platforms called dupes. And, you know, people think of like knockoffs and forgeries where you try to pretend you're a brand that you're not. But dupes is something different. Dupes is, this is a very similar product to a name brand product, but it overtly is not the name brand product, and it's a way better value. And there are now these big cohorts of consumers that talk about their dupes and brag about their dupe finds and, you know, proudly make these dupe decisions. And it feels like those are the kind of things where Timu's playing really well, where, you know, you're into, you know, crafting and you know, there's some expensive machine, a Cricut machine for cutting vinyl. And you say, oh man, I found a dupe on Timu for $20, right? Like those feel like the kinds of occasions they're winning when you're willing to trade down for that that no-name product and take a gamble versus when you know you want the Tide dishwasher soap?
I think that's a great point. They're taking advantage of the trading down phenomenon in general right now that a lot of brands are seeing, a lot of retailers are seeing. And this is the perfect spot. Like, you know, I'll just go ahead and see if Temu has it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't.
Cool. One topic, and this is kind of a jump ball for you guys, is the, you know, I read a lot about this shipping model, and this was always Wish's kind of secret sauce, is there's this like loophole in the postal code where if you send this something small, you know, it doesn't have any tariffs, number one. And then number two, there's like this really cheap postal rate, or I can never remember if China subsidizes it or it's free or we subsidize it, but there's kind of like double loopholes. There's a tariff one and a shipping one. And I've seen some noise lately about people wanting to kind of shut this down. Do you guys, either of you more expert on that than I am and have an opinion on if it's going to be sustainable or not?
I could certainly jump in there. So what you're talking about is there's this thing called the Global Postal Treaty, and it's a prearranged agreement between like 94 countries for how they'll deliver each other's mail. When you try to ship a letter from the U.S. to Germany, the U.S. Post Office is going to hand it to the German Post, and they need to know in advance how much the German Post is going to charge the U.S. Post Office to deliver that so that the U.S. Post Office can charge a rate in advance to you to deliver those things. So this Global Postal Treaty is super valuable, and it makes it possible to cost effectively and you know, with predictable rates, mail stuff all across the world. Unfortunately, there's a couple problems with it. There was the developed nations agreed that for less economically developed nations, they would have a preferred rate. So they would charge even less to deliver. The U.S. Post Office would charge less to deliver mail from a developing economy than they would from an established economy. And until recently, China was characterized as a developing economy, which is probably not accurate. And then the postal treaty specifies a dollar limit that it only is in effect for packages under a certain value. And so this is called the de minimis clause of the postal treaty. In the United States, the threshold is $800. So when Temu ships something to a consumer in the U.S. that costs under $800, they get a predetermined rate from the U.S. Post Office, which is often cheaper than the rate to mail something from one part of the U.S. to the other. And Scott, per your point, there is no tariffs charged on that item, and there is no import inspection on that item. So, you know, normally if a U.S. retailer imports a container of goods from China, there's all kinds of inspections to make sure that the factory in China met labor standards and, you know, met environmental standards, and then they pay tariffs on all that. When the Temu hands one package to the U.S. Post Office, they get to bypass all that, which, you know, is of course controversial. No one wants to get rid of the Global Postal Treaty or even de minimis, but what they're saying is that the U.S.'s $800 threshold is probably way too high. Like China's threshold for reciprocation is something like $40 or something. So you could put a big dent in Temu if you just lowered the threshold. And so there's, you know, noise in Congress about trying to change that limit. I would say that, you know, it is an unfair advantage in many ways, and U.S. companies are certainly right to complain about that. I would say that Temu is different than Wish. Wish took advantage of this clause. Temu takes advantage of it way more effectively, right? So Wish sold, you know, was a marketplace, and they had a factory sell something to an American consumer, and then it was up to the factory to get it to the American consumer. So the factory had to have their own postal account, and then they, you know, had to trigger this postal treaty, and there was no shipping confirmation, and often Wish products took a very long time to ship and a very long time to arrive. As part of this next-gen manufacturing model that Temu has, they do all that for the seller, and it uses Temu's postal account, and they expedite all of these things. Most of these goods get air freighted to the U.S. and put into the U.S. postal system. So while Wish items would have averaged 3 or 4 weeks delivery time, Temu normally averages like 5 to 7 days, and they almost always outperform their shipping promises. And in fact, they even have a guarantee. They give you $5 back if the package arrives late. So, you know, part of the reason that I don't think they're just purely Wish 2.0 is they actually do have a better, more reliable shipping experience than Wish, and they actually more effectively take advantage of this postal loophole than Wish ever did.
Yeah, and Wish took the proceeds of their IPO and built out some fulfillment centers, and they almost did their own version of that Amazon Dragon Boat or whatever that was called. Is Temu signaled they're going to do something like that where they have, you know?
Yeah. So they're in 49 countries now. So they do have DC fulfillment centers in some of those countries. They've actually talked about opening a fulfillment center in Mexico for delivering goods in the Western U.S. And so they are talking about that. But then this other big thing is starting this week that a U.S. seller could list their goods that, you know, the goods are already in a warehouse in the U.S. That U.S. seller could list their goods on Temu and then deliver those goods from a U.S. fulfillment center. So that's a potential way to get much faster delivery times for Temu. And we've already seen some badging. Temu has items with a rapid ship badge that are guaranteed for 2-day delivery. So it does seem like Temu recognizes that over time, their fulfillment model is going to have to be more nuanced than just the individual parcels coming one at a time. But you know, that still seems like the sort of biggest foundation of how they're delivering all these goods.
Got it.
De minimis, though, I can't imagine that much they would change would really have an impact. We're seeing average ticket prices at $38 last month for Temu. Like, are they thinking of reducing it by that much? Or
so, I mean, just talking about way over our skis, like my political acumen is very poor, but yeah, I don't think Congress is going to do anything. I think like at most they'll have a hearing and try to look like tough guys talking about how unfair it is and how they're going to try to protect the American businessman and the American consumer. And then when push comes to shove, they won't do anything, which is my cynical nature. But you're right. Nobody's talking about dropping the de minimis low enough to, you know, really trigger the bulk of these Temu shipments. So it's more likely if they made a change, it would be a gesture, not like, you know, some game changing thing. Now, you know, there's another big Chinese company out there, ByteDance, which is TikTok. And like there is a bill going through Congress right now to ban TikTok. And so, you know, if something like that were to happen with a PDD or Temu, you know, that would, of course, you know, be a big threat of a disruption.
And then on that example you gave, Jason, of a U.S. seller in a fulfillment center, is that Temu's fulfillment center or the seller's fulfillment center?
The seller's fulfillment center. So potentially, okay, what would be one of the ironies of this is, of course, as Amazon has expanded their fulfillment services, you could be an Amazon seller, be using FBA and sell something on Temu and have Amazon fulfill it for you.
Yeah, Wish did something like this. What we found was the U.S. seller struggled to get things in the price point that consumer wanted, right? It's such this low quality stuff that it almost has to be offshore for even to the manufacturer.
I think that you are 100% right there. I don't think they're going to, like, we don't know what the uptake is going to be on these U.S. sellers. It's an interesting talking point, but it doesn't seem like there's going to be a bunch of U.S. sellers that are going to likely participate in this, like, low price dupes demand that they have today. Now, what would be interesting, Pinduoduo, I mentioned, which is a huge entity in China. Pinduoduo started with this same stuff. They started with really inexpensive marketplace goods. And as Pinduoduo got bigger and more established and won the hearts and minds of Chinese consumers, they moved up market. They started selling brand name stuff. They started selling higher quality stuff. And today, they're a hybrid seller. Pinduoduo in China sells their own goods in addition to marketplace items, which I've never seen before. Usually, it always goes the other way. And so there's at least a premise that, like, maybe the U.S. sellers don't, like, add to the current assortment, but maybe the U.S. sellers help Temu round out their assortment with some higher price point, you know, more recognizable goods for the US consumer that helps them win more wallet share.
Interesting. Cool. We're running up against time. Do you guys have any other topics you want to hit before we call it a show?
No, I think it's fair. You know, I already mentioned one of your predictions. I should talk about the other one. Just to pick on Jason for a second. I don't think we'll make it to the 75% of target US e-com this year for Temu, Jason. Sorry. It seems like a stretch.
Man. How do we get Michael on the show more? Like, I'm really enjoying this one. This was a really good
guess. I feel like you're calling
the winner
of the Super Bowl in the first quarter, man. Come on.
Okay, well, I'll just put it this way. At 18% of the U.S. households 3 months into the year, it seems unlikely at their current growth that they get there. My view, basically, though, writing this, is that they've done a great job in the first year of attracting folks with, like, a lot of disposable income to buy things that they likely wouldn't have bought anywhere else, like party supplies, household goods. It's maybe a different model than they have in China. The challenge for them now, you guys both definitely identified this, that it's basically to convince people to switch everyday spending from Amazon and Walmart on those bigger items. And they don't have the assortment right now for that. And that's what you're mentioning. You know, they need to either move up market or figure out what that assortment looks like. But that's going to be a bigger hurdle. They're reaching critical mass. They just have some decisions to make internally at this point.
Yeah. Well, in general, I feel like that is going to be a great place to leave it for this show, because we have run out of our allotted time. But Michael, we really appreciated your insight. We'll certainly have you back. I know your view of the U.S. economy is useful for a whole bunch of topics that come up frequently on the show. But as always, if listeners enjoyed this episode, I hope you will jump on iTunes and leave us that 5-star review.
Thanks, Michael. And this has been really good for Jason's ego. So I feel like you've knocked him down a couple of pegs. I appreciate that. And then if folks want to read more about your writing or connect with you, or is LinkedIn the best place, or are you more active on TikTok? Where can people find you?
Yeah, Michael Maloof on LinkedIn. I'm always posting a lot of Earnest data on there. And then also on our company blog, earnestanalytics.com. Go to the Insights blog and subscribe.
Yep. And I will put links to both the Temu articles you guys published and your LinkedIn in the show notes.
Thank you.
Until next time, happy e-commercing.
You've been listening to the Jason and Scott Show. For all the latest news and trends on e-commerce and shopper marketing, subscribe to us in iTunes or visit www.jasonandscott.com.